Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secret privilege, TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. And today we are joined once again by, I think mutually, our favorite globe-trotting journalist, Pepe Escobar from Asia Times, on the web at atimes.com. Pepe, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Always a pleasure, Peter and Sibel. Always a pleasure.
And last time we talked to you, you were wandering the streets of New York, and you went to Ducati Park as we were following you on your cell phone. And today we find you in Bangkok. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm back in Asia. My old haunts, between Bangkok and Hong Kong, basically.
And is the river back in its banks there in Bangkok?
No. Okay, just a snippet. Yeah. We have in Thailand, we have an exiled prime minister, a convicted felon, who's running this country out of a Cafe Fouchon in a Dubai mall. And his sister, Yong Luk, is the current prime minister.
Right.
She went to Japan last week and she told the Japanese, look, if there is a flood this year, we will contain it and your factories won't be submerged. And the Japanese looked at her and said, really?
And then they gave her a life jacket, right?
Exactly. So this is Southeast Asian politics for you guys.
Yeah. Well, Pepe, there's a lot going on in the world, and we'd like to start talking about the conflict in Syria. And this is something that Sibel and I have been exploring with other interview subjects on this program. And the bottom line is that the U.S. government and the corporate media in this country are giving us a very narrow view of the conflict and presenting the good guys, bad guys. Assad's the bad guy. The Free Syrian Army are the good guys. But we know, our instincts and evidence that is surfacing, that the story is much more layered and complex than that. And you wrote a very strong piece on Valentine's Day comparing the suppression of the uprising in Bahrain with the approval of the Obama administration and other world leaders. And you compared that with the urging coming from the same world leaders that Bashar al-Assad is a brutal dictator who must stop oppressing and killing his people and step down.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, to start with, there are no good guys in this story at all, at all. If we look at the Bashar al-Assad government as a whole, it is basically a very, very harsh police state. But if we look at the Syrian National Council and the so-called Free Syrian Army, it's a similar bunch of defectors, opportunists, and outright gangsters that we saw in Libya a few months ago. So the narrative, so it's basically bad guys against another bunch of bad guys, right?
So this is a film noir.
It is a film noir, and we don't even have a Robert Mitchum moral character at the center of the plot. You know,
yeah.
There is none.
Yeah.
So the problem is, basically, what does that mean for the country, in fact? What we are watching is the slowly fragmentation and disintegration, and I would say Lebanonization in a 1980s concept of Syria. Soon we're going to have services that won't work anymore. Inflation rate would go down the roof. basically normal life as we know it in a relatively stable country slowly disappearing from Syria. And this simmering civil war, we are at a low at the moment, right? But soon we're going to have the Free Syrian Army, or at least some factions within what it's called the Free Syrian Army, more and more weaponized by the U.S., directly or indirectly. It has already been advertised publicly by the Obama administration, and especially by the Saudis. So what we're going to have is a lot of very dangerous Islamists with guns running amok all across Syria, not only close to the Lebanon border, but in Daraa near the Jordanian border, and especially all across the north, near the Turkish border as well. They're doing the back and forth for months now.
Mm-hmm.
So I see this as Lebanon in the 80s, all over again, and of course, in a much bigger country, and with lots of sectarian hatred, in fact. It's not clear-cut, the sectarian hatred between, especially the Sunni majority,
mm-hmm.
let's say 65-70% of the country, and the minorities, including the Alawites who control power, the Kurds, the Druze, and the Christians. The Christians, in fact, are leaving Syria in droves. You know, a lot of them are going if they have the chance, trying to go to Scandinavia, other parts of Western Europe, or at least relocating to the Gulf countries in the Middle East. But in the long run, this is going to be horrible because it will be sectarian-based because the Islamists will have more and more power. So it's not only a question of the Ikhwan, the Muslim Brotherhood, being very, very strong in Syria. It's the fact that Saudi Arabia now will be arming them directly. It will be a replay of Saudi Arabia giving the money to arm the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 80s, but now they're going through their own channels to finance and weaponize this Islamist inside Syria directly. So it's going to be a horror show. I think we are just at the beginning of the whole story.
Mm-hmm. And Pepe, again, on television in the United States, we get either from Channel 4 in Britain or just clips that are pulled off YouTube, videos that show the brutal shelling of civilian neighborhoods by the army.
The Syrian army.
The Syrian army under the control of Assad.
Mm-hmm.
And we then are shown clips from Syrian state television where a very lame anchor person is trying to tell us that this is the work of thugs and gangs and foreign fighters. And in the United States, that falls on deaf ears because it simply sounds like a bizarre denial of the reality that is presented to American viewers. So take a moment here to deconstruct the messages and the images that we are receiving and how they not only oversimplify the situation, but they amount to disinformation.
Totally. And the fact is, a lot of stuff that you see on YouTube is rehearsed. A lot of stuff that you see on CNN, you know, those breathless Syrians intervening on Anderson Cooper, like they are coming out of Mars and saying, look, we are under attack, we're going to die in the next minute. These are rehearsed. And it's been proved already. In fact, on YouTube, you can find people proving that this has been basically a con operation. The fact is, in Homs, it's true. Homs was an urban battle. Most of the suburbs of Homs, and including downtown, they were occupied by a mix of indigenous fighters, defectors, local people who picked up their Kalashnikovs, and a smatter of foreign fighters as well, especially from the Gulf, especially from Qatar and the UAE. And they were being shelled by the Syrian army. The Syrian army, at least for the moment, they won this battle. The fighters decided to retreat. They are now all across northern Syria, in fact. Some are in Idlib. The new offensive by the Syrian army is in Idlib. But we don't know if they're going to retreat for good and cross the border back to Turkey, for instance, and regroup and then come back rearmed, or if they're going to stay lay low for a while in northern Syria while they get the weapons that they really crave. And these weapons are anti-tank missiles. So the moment they get anti-tank missiles, this is going to become really, really nasty. Because the Syrian army, basically, they have, what, at least 5,000 tanks, you know. If these tanks start to be destroyed, you know, another parallel with Afghanistan in the 80s, when the Russian helicopters started to be destroyed by Stinger missiles, that was really, really a turning point. So this could happen in Syria soon. But the propaganda war, it's much more well-coordinated, much more sophisticated than the facts on the ground in Syria. And the propaganda war is being conducted basically by the so-called Syrian Observatory of Human Rights, which is a one-man operation based in London, financed by a very dodgy Dubai foundation. Typical, right?
Now, is that where we get this guy, Danny? I think his last name is Diane.
It's Danny, exactly. Well, very well known in internet circles as Danny.
Yeah. Well, Danny just surfaced on a big media push in the United States last week. He was on CNN. He was on the public television news hour. And he was extremely aggressive in his presentation and essentially saying that the U.S. should intervene now. And he kept saying, people are dying. What more do you need? And it really took me back, Pepe, to the first Gulf War, when the phony story of babies being thrown out of incubators by invading Iraqi forces in Kuwait gained traction in the United States. And it was promoted by a PR firm hired by the Kuwaitis called Hill & Knowlton.
Absolutely.
I ended up interviewing the ambassador's daughter who was promoting that story. And I was able at the time to summon some skepticism, but we didn't have proof at the point that I talked to her that that was false. And so when I saw Danny on TV last week, my first flash was back to the phony Kuwaiti baby incubator story.
You're totally right. Danny is the new incubator. And nowadays it's so sophisticated because you just need one guy running a so-called impartial human rights organization. That's how the Observatory of Human Rights bills itself, in fact. Then you send it to the U.S. You know, he does the media rounds. He gets into many news cycles, and that's all it takes. It's fascinating. Like, this is something that I always argued when I was in Iran, for instance, with the Iranians. You know what you need? You need a Washington PR firm. You need people who speak English. Nobody understands Farsi. If you get one of these guys, you have your case splattered all over the U.S. media and all over the world. Obviously, because they are proud Persians, they'll say, no, no, it has to be under the way we manage. And they have no clue how modern PR, postmodern PR works. So the Libyans had it last year. And the so-called Free Syrian Army and the Syrian National Council, which, by the way, it's another dodgy collection of exiles basically in Paris and in Turkey. They have it as well. And they're being assisted by the fabulous American PR machine, if we can put it this way, and financed by Gulf money. The interest, we all know the interest behind it. They want to basically smash the Assad government by all means necessary, even if that implies a civil war, which is the next step, an outright civil war, because for them the ultimate target is, as we all know, Iran. So if you smash the only Iranian ally in the Middle East, which is Syria, you smash Iran's influence in the Arab world. It's not that automatic, but this is for the Washington PR machine and for the House of Saud. This is what matters, you know.
Well, Pepe.
Yes.
Peter mentioned the U.S. media, which, of course, by now is not surprising to anyone. You know, it has escalated because during the Bush administration or regime, it was, you know, we could pinpoint a few people like Judith Miller and New York Times, but now it seems like it's uniform, everyone. And the same thing with BBC. I mean, the BBC's coverage has been just ludicrous of
ludicrous,
the entire
yeah.
issue. Now, the most really interesting thing for me was the story that we out. outed 2.5 months ago at Boiling Frog Post that had to do with Al Jazeera. Now, you know that a bunch of reporters and producers, they resigned. They blew the whistle on the coverage by Al Jazeera, correct?
And they resigned, actually.
Correct, the people, they did.
The whole bureau in Beirut resigned, in fact.
Now, we wrote a story 2.5 months ago, actually 3 months ago in December, when Al Jazeera broadcast their first filming of Home that is being shelled and is a ghost town now. At that point, I had an Al Jazeera reporter who told me that they went in there on a Friday. You know that Friday is holiday there. And they filmed it at 5 o'clock in the morning in order to show the city as deserted and a ghost town. And this was Al Jazeera when they filmed it. So it was completely staged. Now, this is the thing, saying that, okay, I mean, no Al Jazeera and who they are owned with, but they did it with Libya. And they actually quadrupled it in terms of the turning it into a real propaganda machine. Al Jazeera did it. And this is, we are talking about the most of the people in the Arab world. I mean, right now, even like people in Morocco, they turn into Al Jazeera for their news.
It's true. And this is a very important topic because there is an internal battle raging inside Al Jazeera Arabic at the moment. Well, full disclosure, I write for Al Jazeera English, but I don't know about the in detail about the politics inside Al Jazeera Arabic.
Right.
But the people I know in Al Jazeera English, they have been telling me a few horrifying stories, what's going on, especially in Al Jazeera bureaus across the Middle East. As you mentioned, from Morocco to other countries in the Middle East, a lot of journalists who, you know, they were very proud of what Al Jazeera did covering the Afghanistan and the Iraq war.
Right.
And after Libya, and now especially with Syria, they are appalled, and they are actually resigning. Like I told you, the whole Beirut bureau resigned. Very, very good journalists. And
yes, they have spies, unlike ours over here.
And since Wada Kamfar left, Wada Kamfar already was, he was not at ease at all with the new, let's say, editorial line inside Al Jazeera, which is full steam ahead on all Arab Spring liberation movements, as long as they are in secular Arab republics, example, Libya and Syria, and not a word about what goes on in our neighborhood, meaning the Persian Gulf. And this explains there are no coverage at all of Bahrain. You see some actual coverage in Al Jazeera English, but not in Al Jazeera Arabic. So this is, this comes straight from the top. Straight from the top. The emir told the new Al Jazeera management, this is how it's done. And Al Jazeera became a weaponized media arm of Qatar's foreign policy. In terms of their prestige, all across the Middle East, in fact, it's very, very serious because at least they were trusted. People, for instance, don't trust Al Arabiya because they know that Al Arabiya is basically a House of Saud media arm. But they used to trust Al Jazeera based on their track record, especially in Afghanistan and Iraq. And now they say outright, now it's becoming like a CNN or BBC or one of the American networks. The Americans and the Israelis now are controlling Al Jazeera. This is the word on the street in the Middle East, you know.
Yep.
For their credibility is horrible. But for Qatar's foreign policy aims, this is exactly what they want to do.
Now I want to talk to you about the alternative media here, and that has been the most appalling part for me. And that is, and I think it's because the establishment has been successful in their PSYOP, because when we first started reporting the issue with Turkey and the training in Turkey in November, December, even the alternative media started attacking us and saying, why are you supporting Assad? As if you report on this issue, then automatically you're supporting Assad's regime. I'm like, this has nothing to do with supporting Assad's regime. But what they have turned into, and this has been very successful, Pepe, when you start exposing this stuff, they point finger at you and they say, you are supporting. supporting a dictator. Since you're exposing this, you must love Assad. I'm like, are you kidding me?
You're totally right. In fact, my inbox has been full for the past few months of some of my very angry readers telling me that how much are you being paid by the Assad regime, you know, just because you expose, for instance, that now famous NATO command and control center in Iskenderun, which obviously nobody in the mainstream media talked about it. In a few outlets in alternative media, in English and in other languages as well, even in, I read it in Spanish as well, independent Spanish websites. But now, and it's practically impossible to try to explain that, coming back from the beginning of our interview, there are no good guys in this story.
Pepe.
You have to be against the Syrian National Council. You have to be against the Free Syrian Army. And who's caught in the middle of this crossfire? Syrian people,
right.
Middle class, some of them secular, businessmen, intellectuals, the Google generation, who wanted to have a slightly more democratic state instead of a police state that have been living during the Assad dynasty, in fact. And they are now caught in the crossfire. And they are being completely, I would say, their voices have been exterminated by the voices of intolerance from the West and from the Persian Gulf at the same time.
Now, Pepe, I think you do protest too much, because I think the problem was that you got so much money from Gaddafi that it filled up your Swiss bank accounts.
Exactly.
And when the Assad people tried to wire you money, there wasn't any room for it.
There wasn't any room for it. And in fact, I had to go to my secret locker here where, okay, I have money from a Soviet Russia, I have money from Maoists, anarchists, communists, the Taliban, Gaddafi, you know, Assad. I don't need those horrible...
Peter and Pepe, that's a very good point, because they have been very good. I am very impressed with Russia today. They have been doing a stellar job with reporting. Now, because I've been a guest for a couple of times, it's like, oh, you are working for the Soviet.
Exactly.
And you're still calling it the Soviet Union.
The Soviet.
Right.
Doc. And then you have to say, look, the new Pravda, by the way, is not the old Pravda. The new Pravda is the Washington Post,
New York Times,
the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times. These are the new Pravdas, in fact.
Well, while we're talking about the media, amuse me a little bit, Pepe, and tell me, is Al Hura still on the air in the Middle East, and does anybody watch it? That's the U.S. government's propaganda channel.
Well, the only guys who watch Al Hura are in Langley. That's it. You know, there's nobody else.
Well, they watch it as it's produced, and maybe they're the only viewers, eh?
Absolutely. You know, like I told you, people are even turning off Al Jazeera, because they cannot trust it anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very interesting phenomenon. Small independent websites, such as Al Akbar in Beirut, they have an absolutely outstanding Arabic language website. And they started the English website a few months ago, less than 1 year ago. And in fact, we are studying a partnership between Al Akbar in Asia Times, so we can exchange stories.
Mm-hmm.
They have covered what's going on in Syria from a critical point of view. You cannot find this anywhere else in the Middle East. Anywhere else. It's outstanding. And, you know, it's good for us that now they are translated their best stories from Arabic to English. So this is the future of alternate media in the Middle East, you know. Forget about trying to get your news from the major Middle Eastern networks. Nobody trusts them anymore, you know. People don't trust Syrian and national TV, but now they don't trust Al Jazeera either, you know. It's the same thing.
Pepe, next I want to turn to the coverage that began with Sibel Edmonds at Boiling Frogs Post last November, and she referenced it a moment ago. that she was able to report, based on sources in Turkey and neighboring countries, that U.S. forces were already deployed. And in Jordan, there is a contingent, and also in Turkey. And we now have additional confirmation from a WikiLeaks leak of an email dated December 7th, 2011. And these are the STRAT-4 emails that have been leaked. And for people who aren't aware, STRAT-4 is it's billed as a Texas-based global intelligence company. And I've been getting free emails from them with their kind of declassified propaganda for several years.
Yeah.
And so WikiLeaks got into their server, and they have released a number of these emails. And the one I have is from someone named B. Hala at strat4.com to an email address called secure@strat4.com. And it is a meeting based on, I spent most of the afternoon at the Pentagon with the U.S. Air Force Strategic Studies Group. And he goes on to say, they wanted to grill me on the strategic picture in Syria, so after that, I got to grill them on the military picture. There is still a very low-level understanding of what is at stake in Syria. After a couple of hours of talking, they said without saying that teams, presumably from the U.S., U.K., France, Jordan, Turkey, are already on the ground, focused on reconnaissance missions and training opposition forces. One Air Force intel guy, U.S., said very carefully that there isn't much of a Free Syrian Army to train right now anyway, but all the operations being done now are being done out of prudence. The way it was put to me was, look at it this way. The level of information known on Syrian Orbat this month is the best it's been since 2001. They've been told to prepare contingencies and be ready to act within 2 to 3 months, but they still stress that this is all being done as contingency planning, not as a move toward escalation. And one more bite from this. He said that they would use Cyprus as the staging area. And then they talk a little bit about what it would take to get American support. And he writes, he said, they don't believe air intervention would happen unless there was enough media attention on a massacre, like the Gaddafi move against Benghazi. They think the U.S. would have a high tolerance for killings as long as it doesn't reach that very public stage. They're also questioning the skills of the Syrian forces that are operating the country's air defenses currently and how significant the Iranian presence there is. So this reveals quite a bit. First of all, it's independent confirmation of Sibel Edmonds' Enterprise reporting. Sibel, you can take a victory lap.
No, Sibel, it was a global scoop.
It was, but as you know, I came under attack, and neither the major alternative dare touching the story, of course not the mainstream media, and as you said, it was picked up by all the, you know, more credible foreign channels, including Russia Today, but not here in the United States, not a peep.
No, because it goes against the established narrative. The established narrative is a Hollywood good guy, bad guy thing. And we always come back to it. It's immensely more complicated than that. And you broke the story that these people were already on the ground. We already knew there was the command and control center in southern Turkey. Then we started to learn of the infiltrations from Turkey and from Lebanon, and from weapon smuggling, especially through the Lebanon route. But this goes again, you know, and especially the left and progressives all over the world, they have a problem. They have to compartmentalize the way they think. Is this an imperialist or an anti-imperialist fight? You know, they cannot see things in between or in shades of gray.
Pepe, next, I'd like to contextualize this around the AIPAC week in Washington, Netanyahu's visit, the media narrative that Obama talked him down from an imminent attack on Iran.
Yeah.
And my first stab at this is just how callous various players are given that we have, you know, we still have the remnants of a civil war that is growing, I think, in Iraq. We have a situation that's out of control in Afghanistan. We are attacking Yemen on an almost daily basis. We have a hot internal conflict in Syria. And so for Israel to be thinking about adding an assault on Iran as a preemptive strike against the purported nuclear development there, it just really seems to be these layers of madness.
Absolutely. In fact, every day in the morning, I have, after my coffee, I have my early morning dose of rage when I look at the global headlines, in fact. And, you know, I have some special sections in my Google News, you know, Israel and Iran. They are at the top of my news feed in the morning. And every day is the same story. They are being for blood, you know. Before IPAC, during IPAC, now after IPAC, and especially now that Obama, in my view, very cleverly dodged the bullet from IPAC and Bibi, and he postponed the story to 2012, basically said, look, or 2013, sorry. He basically said, look, there's not going to be war on my watch at the end of my term. The problem is they can try to build facts on the ground in terms of a false flag. There's, you know, ample opportunities for a false flag this next few months.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the Iranians, who have been watching this very, very closely, they decided, okay, we're coming back to the negotiating table. Probably it's going to be in April, because they had consulted with Turkey before, and Turkey said, man, maybe this could be here in Ankara or in Istanbul. So the P5, the permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, they'll be back with Iran. They'll be discussing all over again. The problem, and the Iranians said, now we're open to all possibilities. But all possibilities in Washington's view is you stop enriching uranium to 20%, you continue to be subjugated to our sanctions, and then we talk. So it's the rollover and die approach to diplomacy, right? And obviously, it's impossible. What the Iranians expect is what Turkey and Brazil did in 2010. They went to Tehran, they discussed for 18 hours nonstop, and in the end, they had a deal, which was bombarded by the West the next day by Hillary Clinton. So the Iranians, they want just a little bit of respect so they can build some mutual trust in the negotiating table, which has evaporated completely. But when we come back to the original motivation of the whole story, which is not the nuclear dossier, but regime change, which has been acknowledged by any number of top players in the U.S., Pentagon, CIA, even inside the Obama administration, there cannot possibly be any sort of a mutual understanding, right? But the most important thing I think at the moment is the hysteria by the Likud government and in Israel and the AIPAC lobby, especially in the U.S., Obama dodged the bullet. But you can also argue that he dodged it in a very abject fashion, because basically he caved in the long run. He said, maybe we'll leave all options open. The military incentive of option, I don't know how he phrased it exactly, it's still on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And he mentioned the window of opportunity of Iran to basically submit to what the Americans are pressuring Iran about. So what kind of negotiation is this? Huh?
And Pepe, you mentioned false flag, and we've discussed psychological operations here, and there are layers. Everybody knows about the brazen attacks on Iranian nuclear scientists. We also know about the bullshit story of our Bob Sear, the Iranian-American used car dealer who was plotting with a DEA agent he thought was a Mexican drug cartel guy to blow up the Saudi ambassador to Washington.
And the Fast and the Furious plot. Yeah.
And as recently as last week, the Israeli ambassador, Michael Oren, was repeating that story as fact. And there is no challenge to that in the U.S. media. So we have dueling psychological operations. I wanted to get your reaction to the allegations that in the Republic of Georgia, in India, and I believe the third was in Indonesia, that Israeli diplomats or other Israeli persons have been targeted in plots that are attributed to the Iranians.
Azerbaijan.
Azerbaijan, thank you.
Zach, and here in Bangkok, in fact. And here in Bangkok. And the investigation here in Thailand, they said it was probably something that went wrong, conducted by some very amateur operators, and they could not establish a connection between what happened here and what happened in India, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the, you know, this is Bangkok police, in fact. And, in fact, in the first 3 or 4 days, there was a barrage of Israeli diplomats and operators here in the Thai press pointing the fingers to an official Iranian operator. The problem is, you know, the Thai press, in English or in Thai, they are not very critical. Their investigative capabilities are not exactly strong, you know. So they were just parroting what Israelis told them. And then finally we got an interview with the Iranian ambassador here in Thailand. And he said, look, as long as we have proof that this is official, we will conduct our own investigation and people will be punished for it. And then the issue completely disappeared. The Iranians were apprehended here. One is still here in Thailand. He blew off his own legs because when one of the grenades exploded. The other two went back to Iran. The issue completely disappeared. We don't even know where the investigation is going. What is certain is this was not an official Iranian operation. It was probably a rogue, mini cell, Iranian cell of disgruntled Iranian citizens who were trying to go for some payback for the assassination of nuclear scientists in the streets of Tehran, by the way, conducted by the Mossad. And even the possibility of a false flag. These were probably people recruited by the Mossad. It started to be discussed even within the Thai press in English. You know, so the problem is once you go over the first 3 or 4 days of nonstop Israeli propaganda, you start to see the holes in the story. The same with the Fast and the Furious. The Fast and the Furious were so absurd that within the first few hours we knew that this could not possibly hold, right? But with the attempted assassinations, let's put it this way, in especially in Asia here, in Iran, in India and in Thailand, you could see the holes only after a few days.
So much smoke and so many mirrors and so many confusing layers. And here, I know a lot of people are talking about Obama and the recent visit by, you know, Bibi, but 3-4 months ago, and these are some really, really good, reliable inside sources. They told me, they said, Iran is going to be after the elections, regardless who is elected. And whether it's Obama or it's Romney, it is the plan for the real ultimate plan for Iran is after the election, presidential election. And that was being talked about in these, you know, pretty tight circles in November, December, long before he came here. Now, it's almost like a good cop, bad cop show being put in there because if many of his constituents, Obama, they basically going to applaud and he wants to get reelected. So I think there is more smoke here than meets the eye. I think that's one of the issues here. And the part that Pepe is confusing to me, and I would like to get your take on that, is the entire modus operandi. Because if the objective is regime change, the last thing you want to do is showing this external threat to the Iranians. Because, you know, I was in Iran when the revolution took place. You know, we were all anti-Shah, you know, all of us, the socialists and communists and the liberal and the progressives and the Islamists, okay? Mm-hmm. And then the Islamists, they partnered up with Mujahideen Khalq, okay, the MEK.
They said,
let's go and get rid of Hezbollah. Let's get rid of the communists, right? And then later, the Islamists went after the MEK, and they kicked them out and they stayed in power. But the first couple of years was when they were most volatile. And this is the Islamic regime there, okay?
Yes.
And what actually helped them to get themselves really strong and ingrained, because I was living through this whole thing, was the Iran-Iraq war. Because once that took place, everybody united. When you are facing the external enemy, I don't care whether it's China or if it's U.S. or if it's Russia, that's when the people, they said, let's put our differences aside. Right now, we have to take care of our external enemy before we look into this new government and say, what the heck is going on? And that helped, actually, the war helped establish this government. Because, so, with all these little theatrical things that are coming here and there, including the sanctions, even though economically that really hurts, it's, the effect is opposite, because all these operations are actually strengthening the nationalism feeling in Iran.
You're absolutely right, Sybil. And this proves, once again, that the people who are devising the strategy to deal with Iran don't know absolutely anything about Iranian society and how Iran works, and how Persians are so proud, proud of their history, proud of their culture, and extremely nationalistic. Everybody knows that if there is an attack, already with the threat of an attack, and if there is an actual attack, everybody will rally behind the regime. The people know it, even people in the opposition in Iran know it, and the regime know it. And now that they are even stronger, after the past elections,
sure,
they controlled everything in Iran except parliament. Now they control 80% at least of parliament as well.
Sure.
So they control, you know, all the instances of power inside Iran. They sideline the Green Movement and the leaders of the Green Movement completely. So they are in full control. It is the accomplished military dictatorship of the Mullahtariat, like I've been calling them for two or three years now, and with the revolutionary guard in total control and in controlling most of the economy as well, they sideline the Ahmadinejad faction. They're going to elect the next president, which is probably going to be Larijani, which is a protege of Ayatollah Khamenei. Ayatollah Khamenei is in very good health, so he's probably going to be in power for at least another 10 years or so. So, you know, they are on, you know, top of the world as far as they are concerned. So now that they are united, their internal propaganda will be totally directed into regimenting the population against the threat of a foreign attack or invasion. So whatever happens in Iran, there won't be regime change because of sanctions or because of an attack. But people in Tel Aviv, for obvious reasons, but people in Washington who devise policy, they simply cannot understand it. Why don't they talk to some Farsi-speaking Iranian experienced State Department diplomats? And there are many, but they won't, right?
And some of the people who are posing within the think tanks, who even appear to be anti-war, they are the ones that actually I fear most, Pepe, because I have many friends here. Well, there is this large group in D.C. I'm sure you have heard of them. These are the previous monarchists who come, and they every week they get together with Shah's Fufu's son, who lives here in his palace in Potomac.
Yes.
And they have their nice, I have been to a couple of those dinners in 1990s, and you have nice Persian dishes and stuff, and they keep dreaming about going back there and taking back their mansions and those big lands that they basically made off the back of people, okay? These are the corrupt people we revolted against, you know, Shah and his cronies, and they have not given up on that dream. They get together, they have been doing it for 25, 30 years. They get together and they keep dreaming about going back and reclaiming their land and palaces.
You're right, Sybil. And when they look at Libya, they say, we might get a shot. The relative of King Idris is back in Libya.
And he's
probably going to be the emir of Cyrenaica, you know.
And the Indians have so much money because some of them, they brought a lot of gold and money to U.S., you know. They escaped their around in the right time. So they are pretty loaded. But like idiots, they've been giving money like crazy to various lobbyists, charlatans, to go and advocate on their behalf and give them a little role. And then you have the MEK, Mojahedin al-Khalq, doing the same thing. You know, they are dreaming of going there and getting into power. And then you have these weasels who actually are insider CIA, who are posing as semi-anti-war. They were actually supporting that fake Twitter revolution in Iran. Those are the ones that actually are the most dangerous, because it looks like, oh, here, because at least the liberals, they think, ah, this is Iranian, and he is anti-war, and therefore, what he's saying is true. And by the way, Peter, you had one of the most shadiest men on your show, Trita Parsi.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know him very, very well, and you couldn't go lower than this guy in terms of who he really works for.
And who does he work for, the Shah?
I like Trita a lot, but he can be very dodgy sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that man is the... He's a very good actor, and he's been on the payroll of Langley for a long time, Peter. You can't go dirtier and worse than this guy, okay? He's very good. He has put on a very good show. He's a very good showman. And a lot of good, you know, smart Iranians around, but he is a very, very good showman.
Mm-hmm.
But be afraid of those people, because they are going to talk this mild language, and they are the Twitter revolutionists, actually. They are the ones who are the scariest. These hoo-ha-ha people, you know, with bomb Iran and Santorum and all the stuff, don't be afraid of those people. Those guys are so obvious, and they are idiots. Be afraid of those smart ones who actually are gaining the trust and coming across as the experts on Iran. Okay, so that's the warning stuff. But Pepe, I mean,
yes.
You talked about the stupidity and the fact that these plots are just so amateurish, but that doesn't fit with Israel's modus operandi. They are much smarter than that. Israelis are not like, you know, some of these novice people in the U.S., like, let's go do this. They are far more sophisticated. So it just somehow, that's why I keep saying smoke and mirrors. These amateurish jobs, all this brouhaha threats, actually, it must be a cover for something, because they are smarter, they are savvier, they are more sophisticated. I know they want Iran, but the way they are going about it may be the smoke for actually the things that we are not looking at or seeing. What do you say to that?
Yes, in fact, both sides are very smart and sophisticated. Okay, the Mossad can bungle, just like the CIA. We know there's many precedents. And the Al-Quds force on the Iranian side, they are extremely sophisticated. They will never mount operations such as the one in Thailand or in India. No way. It could be a false flag, but it could be a false flag subcontracted to some amateur groups as well. But from the Israeli side, or from the Iranian side, or with a tenuous connection to somebody inside the Mossad or inside the Al-Quds force. But it doesn't make sense for anybody. It makes sense in terms of ratcheting up the public perception that Iran is doing evil deeds all across the world. Okay, in terms of the general agenda of the Likud government in Israel, it works for them. On the other hand, it's so amateurish that, look, if these people, they cannot conduct an operation like this, how do they want to do regime change in Iran, right? So it doesn't make sense altogether. What I think that the really, really, what we are not seeing in terms of the shadow war is how the ultimate false flag, the Gulf of Tonkin moment, is going to be organized. And how is going to explode? Is it going to be a provocation in the Strait of Hormuz with an Iranian patrol boat, for instance? Is it going to be a sort of underground bomber sort of scheme in a big American city? This is going to be the casus belli, and I think the Israelis are working towards it little by little. Clumsily or not, I would expect this could happen. There is a window of opportunity, to borrow Obama's phrase, that this might happen before November, like a kind of a October surprise, right? Mm-hmm. And it would force the United States to intervene. But I'm sure the White House, who is totally against a war, let's put it this way, would not fall into the trap. Maybe if there is a Fast and Furious plot in terms of an October surprise, probably we'll have people from the White House trying to, you know, dismantle the bomb. Let's put it this way, you know.
Well, unfortunately, Obama has given an insurance policy essentially to the Israelis, saying we've got your back. They can start it, and we'll have to clean it up. But Pepe,
exactly.
I want to try to get into the mindset, as difficult as this is, of the Israeli leadership, because in my view, they've benefited from a balance of terror and being surrounded by hardline dictators. And with Egypt now in flux, it's very hard to see exactly what's going to come out there. And with Syria, a very important neighbor of Israel, in a hot civil war or a major internal conflict at this time, it's hard to imagine that they see it in their interest to further destabilize the dictators who have provided stability and a strong opposition for Israel to rally its citizens around. So I don't quite get the calculation that all of this regime change is in Israel's self-interest at this particular time.
They're scared, basically. They are scared because the old order is... It's not collapsed totally. It's collapsing very, very fast. They don't have an ally in Egypt anymore. They know that the next government in Egypt is going to be a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government, which will definitely want to revise the Camp David Accord.
Mm-hmm.
They are terrified about that. They look at Syria, and they don't know if there is a post-Assad Syria. In fact, they know that the possible post-Assad Syrian government would be also Muslim Brotherhood-controlled, and it will be antagonistic to Israel interests. They can live with Assad because there is an accommodation with the Assad dynasty for decades now. They can live with that. You know, the Syrian army with their 5,000 tanks, they're not going to reclaim the Golan yesterday, today, or tomorrow. So for the Israelis, this is fine, right? At the same time, they look at, they want to divert attention from the Palestinian Gulag.
Yeah.
Let's put it this way, essentially. Mm-hmm. What better way to not talk about the Palestinians, which for these Likudniks, in fact, they are a non-people, as we all know. So then to talk about the existential threat from Iran. And they frame the terms of the debate in terms of the existential threat. It's not that Iran wants to wipe Israel off the map. In fact, who's writing a people off the map as we speak is Israel compared to in relation to the Palestinians. It's the if Iran, if we all know if IAEA, NIEs in the U.S., there's no bomb in this picture. But if there was an Iranian nuclear bomb, the current balance of forces in the Middle East would change completely, because the only ones who have between the 300 and 400 nuclear weapons, as everybody knows but nobody acknowledges in public, mm-hmm. is Israel.
Right.
So they have to reframe the existential threat in terms of there's going to be a second Holocaust. And they know that this resonates wildly in the U.S. and Western Europe. In Western Europe, less and less, because Europeans are very much aware of what's going on in Palestine. And they support the Palestinian cause. And they can see the difference between an actual existential threat and Israeli manipulation. In the U.S., this still plays fabulous for the gutters because of complicity of U.S. mainstream media, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the way I read the whole thing is they are scared, and they simply don't know how the next Middle East is going to be. They look at Iraq, which a war that they wanted in the first place, a war that they forced to the Bush administration, and when the Israeli forces that were inside the Bush administration, they were there, they launched the war that they had planned years before.
Right.
In 1998, in fact, this war was planned, right? So But now they look at Iraq and they see Iraq, there is, in terms of, it's not a relation of a subjugation, by all means. But the Maliki government in Iraq is in very, very good terms, in strategic terms and in commercial and trade terms, with the Iranian leadership as well. So they look at it and they see a Shiite axis that might be very confrontational vis-a-vis Israel. No, Iraq doesn't want to confront Israel. Iraq wants good trade relations. They want to start selling their oil again and rebuild the country that was destroyed by UN sanctions and by an American invasion and occupation. Little different thing. But the Israelis don't understand that, that story. And basically, Iran, they see as a top regional power. And in fact, Iran is the major power in Southwest Asia. And that's why Israel is aligned with Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf monarchies, Sunnis, all of them, and some of them very hardcore. And in terms of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they are Wahhabis, in fact. They are intolerant, essentially. So when they look at Iran, they see these guys have among the largest, the second largest oil reserves in the world, second largest gas reserves in the world. If there are no American sanctions or Western sanctions, they could be selling this oil and gas all over and making a fortune, and they will become a rich, developed country in a few years, maybe a decade or so. And we're going to be, shrinking here, our small 7 million country, surrounded by enemies, and still having to deal with the Palestine problem, which for them is a huge problem because they see it as basically a huge gulag, and they want to keep it this way. And on top of it, they are not even talking about their own borders. How can you have a modern state which never defines its own borders? It's a small, belligerent, nuclear-armed state. So, you know, when I'm not trying to get inside the minds of the Likud people in Israel. It's impossible, of course. Even Israelis can't do it. But when they look around, they see threats all over. And even an internal threat, because a lot of Israelis don't agree with this government. They want a better, you know, those protests in Israel a few months ago, they are, you know, replica of the Arab Spring, in fact, you know, was about conditions of living conditions inside Israel itself. Even though Israel may be a sort of a New York City in the middle of an enormous Sahara Desert, but still, you know, the inequality inside Israeli society is also very huge. And they could profit if they made deals with their neighbors, if they renounced expansionism and belligerence. We could have a Middle East totally integrated. And, you know, in a decade or so, we could have Palestine as a successful state as well. We all know this is not going to happen, but the solution would be around the corner if only they wouldn't think with. If only they didn't have this siege mentality implanted in their genes. And I'm not sure they're going to get rid of it anytime soon. You know.
Well, and Pepe, just on that note, when Netanyahu completed his visit to Washington, the cynic in me said, well, they're going to announce some new illegal settlements on Palestinian land. And I was wrong. Instead, they launched an assault on Gaza, used a drone strike, kind of like Obama did with al-Awlaki in Yemen, to take out a Palestinian Revolutionary Council leader. And that led to an exchange of fire that lasted for 4 days and left 23 Palestinians dead.
Exactly. And nobody in the U.S. the mainstream media is even talking about it now. This you'd see probably page 12B somewhere. You know, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And Israel can do anything they want. In fact, even more than the U.S. Like, you know, the latest Kandahar massacre, in fact. I was writing about that 2 days ago, in fact. Which is a Haditha moment or a Milai moment, in fact. It got, you know, at least U.S. mainstream media had to deal with it. Of course, with the usual, this is not us, you know, this is not the ethos of our men in uniform, but they had to talk about it. But whatever Israel does in terms of killing innocent civilians in Gaza, it's blank. It's easy. They know they can get away with it, you know.
Pepe,
that's the real horror for me, in fact.
Yeah. Pepe, thank you for joining us today. Sibel and I have great admiration for you, and we always learn a lot to Pepe Escobar.
Come on. We only scratched the surface, you know. That's the best we can do.
No, we have to have this another interview very soon. As you know, things are unfolding back to back, so we'll keep our listeners informed. Thank you very much, Pepe.
Thank you so much, Peter and Sibel. Always an enormous pleasure talking to you both.
Joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.